When we originally set today as the first opening thing, we anticipated some more space available for a more continuous process, but unfortunately it's going to be a little bit of a stop-start process. And that partly relates to the fact that we need to allow 2 weeks for public comment in terms of the bill. So it really means that we can only, once we've had a briefing from the department, we can only really get going with public hearings insofar as we will need them early in October again. We've checked with the leader of government business in terms of arrangements, in terms of getting into the National Assembly and so on, and they're okay with not meeting as we'd originally intended, finalizing it at a committee stage here this month. And getting into the National Assembly this month, so we will certainly meet the target of getting this legislation to the plenary sessions of the National Assembly somewhere in the middle of October, I think toward middle or latter part of October. So that's our target here as the National Assembly Portfolio Committee. So I also then apologise to members, parliamentary members, because I realise we've flown you down for one day and then we'll fly you back and so on. We thought that we would have a few more days on it, but it's not going to be practical. But anyway, let's use today to be familiarized, to have the bill in front of us and for the department to explain to us. And then we'll move ahead and we'll give some sense of dates and things that we're aiming at. Okay, so it's not the most elegant way of proceeding, but it's the way that we need to do it in order to do justice to what we've got. Okay, so then welcome to our colleagues. We'll ask them to introduce themselves, our colleagues from the department, and then the author from CAA. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Anwar Ghani, the Chief Director of Civil Aviation for the department. Thank you for the warm welcome, and just to note, the Commissioner for the CAA will be joining us in about half an hour's time. He's on his way as we speak.
Okay, thank you. Had a problem, no doubt, with road transport.
I hope not.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Johan Bernardi, and I'm a consultant assisting the Department of Transport.
I'm Alison
Moon
from the Office of
the Ship Table
Advisor.
My name is Johan Bielman from the Department of Transport.
Morning, Chair. My name is Jan Kellerman, also acting as a consultant to the CIA department.
Morning, all. My name is Rennie van Sail. I'm a consultant to the Civil Aviation Authority at this time. I was party to the creation of the Civil Aviation Authority way back in 98. I have about 38 years' experience in aircraft accident investigation. seven and a half years with the International Civil Aviation Organization based in Montreal, as in the accident investigation prevention section, and also 4 years as a safety oversight auditor. And I've seen quite a lot of states in the world and how accident investigation.
Hopefully you'll be able to be with us
in the public hearings as well later on. I mean, your expertise is going to be important, as indeed we will be others. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. My name is Sandy Lucasie. I'm a consultant to the Department of Transport.
Morning, Chair. Johannes Machar to the Department of Transport Legal Services.
He's the one that has a hard job. Well, welcome to everybody then, and shall we then kick off and go straight into an orientation as to what actually is in the bill of
conduct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The presentation is quite lengthy, but in order to expedite the process, perhaps I'll just open up by stating how we got here and what we brought together in terms of composing this bill. As you know, aviation legislation in South Africa is pretty old. We have the Aviation Act of 1962, and then we have various other pieces of legislation, like the South African Civil Aviation Authorities Act, which was passed in 1998. Now, the Aviation Act of 1962 is quite a strong piece of legislation. It stood the test of time, And in our move going forward with the new bill as such, we used the Aviation Act of 1962 as the spine, and we didn't construct it around it because 99% of the regulations flow out of the Aviation Act of 1962, the technical standards and the civil aviation regulation process as such. The purpose of this bill that we have currently is threefold. Firstly, it seeks to give South Africa's obligations to comply with the regulation of the International Civil Aviation Organization and to address the recent comments and assessment by the Federal Aviation Administration, which we had late last year and earlier this year, as well as the International Civil Aviation Organization's Universal Safety Audit Program, which they conducted in South Africa later last year. In the second instance, the bill seeks to harmonize the current civil aviation legislation. And in the third instance, the bill is aimed at compliance with our country's obligation, international obligations relating to applicable international conventions and international agreements. It's pretty much straightforward. The bill is very technical in nature. And Mr. Chairman, if you have any technical questions, we have the CAA present. And if we aren't able to answer, you will respond within the course of the week on technical issues.
Okay, thank you.
All right. As captured, the first slide just provides the background that I've highlighted, and in doing so, it also outlines that the act that we will repeal once this bill is proclaimed as an act, that will be the Aviation Act of 1962, the Civil Aviation Offences Act of 1972, and then the South African Civil Aviation Authorities Act of 1998. The Offences Act of 1972, as you know, back in 72, it was quite a peaceful era for aviation, subsequent to which we had a number of volatile situations globally. And we now had the opportunity to strengthen the Act on a number of legs, one being, for example, baggage handling at the airport, unruly behavior on the aircraft. And you'll find that in terms of the bill, it's been well outlined for offences and what would happen should one offend as such. Okay. The bill in section 1, it's very straightforward. It provides definitions ranging from what's an aerodrome to what's a coordinator and a director. So it just clearly outlines each definition and standard as applies across the bill. Okay. Section 2 of the bill deals with the Act, the Convention and Tacit Agreement, and they apply to basically every aircraft, aerodrome, and air navigation facility, aviation facility, airports, operators that enter and exit an aerodrome, as well as the owners of aircraft. Also applies to every person employed in connection with the aerodromes and the air navigation facilities and airports. It applies to all foreign registered aircraft and personnel of such aircraft operating within the Republic and over its territorial waters, as well as all South African aircraft and personnel in or outside the Republic as such. Okay. Then the bill deals with the aircraft and airport heliports or helisop belonging to the Defence Force and SAP. We need to pause via the convention and transit agreement does not apply to this particular group of aviators as such, and we can understand why, because it's more military and more policing in nature, whereas the transit agreement deals with commercial aviation, the transfer of passengers and cargo for it also deals with aircraft also used by customs services, because once again it's a state operated unit and doesn't deal with the transfer of passengers or cargo, it deals with just customs services and such. Okay. Section 3 deals with, in terms of the Minister in consultation may issue proclamations for carrying out the Convention Transit Agreement, and he may do all things necessary to ratify amendments to the Convention Transit Agreement. So this is our international obligation. Section 4, the Minister is responsible for carrying out the Act, Convention and Transit Agreement, and every person appointed under a concern with carrying out of the Act, excluding, as outlined earlier, members of SAP or the Defence Force, must perform functions in a manner which gives effect to the Act, and the Minister must designate the South African Civil Aviation Authority as the appropriate authority for the purposes of carrying out the functions of the relevant Act. Okay, the enactment of the Convention Transit Agreement is in Section 5, and basically the Convention Transit Agreement have, subject to this Act, will be the force of law in the Republic. In terms of Section 6, we're dealing with the acquisition of land and rights in connection with licensed airports. The minister may acquire land and interest in land adjoining or adjacent to any aerodrome. And the minister may acquire land and interest in land for the purposes of erection and maintenance of aids to safety in air navigation. In Section 7, subject to the relevant legislation, the Minister of Minerals and Energy may permit the use of specific land for the establishment of airports and other related functions as such. In Section 8, where we talk about trespass nuisances, responsibility for damage or loss by registered owners and operators of aircraft, no action lies in respect of trespass nuisances by reasons only of the flight of aircraft over any property at air height which is reasonable in compliance with the Act, Convention and Transit Agreement. And damage or loss caused by aircraft in flight or any person in such flight or article falling from aircraft may be recovered from the registered owner of the aircraft. And in the registered owner or operator of the aircraft must have insurance relating to damage or loss caused by the aircraft as such.
This is only on no action lies in respect.
Okay. Basically, what you're saying here is we know that obviously aircraft fly in the air, and as a result of any action, you can't directly relate it to being a nuisance or a trespass as such. The controls we have in place, Mr. Chairman, is that the South African Civil Authority will determine minimum height and in terms of accessible operational practice. So, just in layman's term, you're not going to get someone flying over your house at 100 meters, peering into your backyard as such. The CAA applies the regulations quite stringently, and they will determine what is the appropriate height for you to fly over and such.
But it's also
indemnified. Yes, it indemnifies the aircraft, yes, in case, something does fall off as such. But then the last point is in terms of the protection clause, there is the insurance factor that the aircraft operator must have insurance. So should damage result, there is the insurance coverage on the issue. This particular area of the Aviation Safety Investigation Board is something entirely new in the bill. Okay, and just for sake of presentation, Mr. Chairman, you'll notice on the presentation on the top right-hand corner there's a tick. So whatever's new in the bill or in the new act as such, we've ticked it off so that we flag it to say it's new. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is our compliance issue in terms of Annex 13 of the Chicago Convention. It's a number of annexes. And what Annex 13 requires of the state is for the state to have an independent accident investigation unit as such. And that unit's mandate is to investigate aircraft accidents, but with a no-blame apportionment as such. So you cannot use the findings of this accident investigation board for prosecution purposes or to blame any party, because the principle applied here is that if an incident does occur, the people must come up voluntarily and say, fine, I as the commander of the aircraft made an error. And the sole purpose is to prevent the reoccurrence of the incident as such. Okay. And as we will notice, in terms of the Section 9, the chapter applies to aircraft accidents and incidents. It's in or over the Republic, and any place that is under the Republic's air traffic control. In or over any place if the Republic is requested to investigate the aircraft accident incident, and the aircraft incident involves an aircraft that is operated by a person in possession of a South African aviation authorization or any other aviation approval document as such. The investigation board is a juristic person. Its purpose is to advance aviation transportation safety by independently investigating and making findings as to the causes and contributing factors. It will also, in its nature of investigation, identify safety deficiencies, to make recommendations to eliminate or reduce safety deficiencies, to report publicly on investigations and findings. It will promote compliance with and investigate aircraft accidents and aircraft incidents in compliance with Annex 13 to the Convention. As I said, no apportionment of blame or liability, and does not determine civil or criminal liability, and this is a very important element. It does not have the determination powers for criminal liability as such. And its sole objective is to prevent accidents and incidents of reoccurring. the investigation board made to achieve its objectives, or if requested by the minister, investigate aircraft accident or aircraft incidents, no department, excluding Department of Defense, may commence an investigation if an aircraft accident, aircraft incident is investigated by the investigation board as such. Any department that is informed that the aircraft accident incident is proposed to be investigated by the incident board, they will be advised. A department may contribute to investigation for purposes other than for determining causes or contributing factors. And, you know, we could have a number of scenarios for research and development, for trying to find out, you know, what the impact would have been in terms of environmental issues. So there could be other parallel investigations that could be run. The South African Police Services may investigate for any purpose for which it is empowered to do so, so that we do not prevent the South African Police Services from continuing with their investigation. The investigation board must not inquire into any aircraft accident or aircraft incident where a prosecution, interest, inquiry has been established by the minister, which was instituted or completed before commencement of this act. Okay. Next slide. The coordination of investigations is covered in section 13, and we say that where a department, excluding Department of Defense, investigates an aircraft accident investigation, the investigation board and such department must coordinate activities. The requirement in interest of the investigation board takes precedence over that of a department in case of a conflict of interest. And when an aircraft accident incident is investigated by the board, the Department of Defense or staff or visiting force take reasonable steps to ensure coordination. The section 14 covers the compatible procedures and practices. The board must ensure that investigation procedures and practices are compatible with international agreements, conventions, and judicial inquests in terms of the Inquest Act. In terms of section 15, we look at the institutional arrangements for the appointment of members, the filling of vacancies in terms of office. The board consists of not more than 5 members appointed by the minister, of which one must be a full-time member and chairperson. The chairperson is appointed for a term of 3 years and is eligible for reappointment for 1 further term only. And there's a very good reason why we've inserted this in the Act. Given the mandate of the board as such, we don't want to have a stalemate where we have someone that holds office for 20 years and becomes too accustomed with the stakeholders in the industry. The third bullet point, members of the board is appointed for a term not exceeding 3 years and are eligible for reappointment, and members must be South African citizens permanently resident within the Republic. The procedure and requirements of appointing members of the board, nominations are requested and submitted to relevant parliamentary committees, and a shortlist is drawn up. The members must collectively be knowledgeable of aviation transportation, and these are the factors appointing members: the technical knowledge related to aviation, special skills and technical qualifications, knowledge in aircraft reconstruction, safety engineering, etc., and any other appropriate factors as may be deemed. Okay, in terms of the remuneration fees and expenses, the chairperson and appointed members must be paid remuneration allowances and reasonable travel and living expenses as determined. And section 18 covers the duties of the chairperson. Chairperson manages personnel, financial and property matters, and also apportions work, convenes meetings and presides at meetings. The delegation of powers and quorum is covered in section 19 and 20. The chairperson may delegate specific powers. The board must not meet less than 12 times a year, and the rationale behind this is that the board must meet at least once a month. Okay, and 3 members form a quorum. The expenditure in the Public Finance Management Act is in sections 21 and 22. Expenditure for execution of functions of the board to be paid out of money appropriated by Parliament, and the board must comply with the provisions of the PFMA. Conflict of interest is covered in section 23. It makes provision for the disclosure of interest and granting of permission by the minister for holding interest in civil aviation activities. The duties are covered in section 24. Members must make rules regarding the conduct of business at meetings, establish policies regarding the classes of aircraft accidents and aircraft incidents to be investigated, identify safety deficiencies and make recommendations, and the members must submit an annual report to the minister. Appointment of staff, section 25. After consultation of the minister, the board must appoint a director of investigations, other investigators and staff. And I'm going to pause on this for now. Currently, our setup is as follows. We do have an accident and incident mediation unit, which is the responsibility of the Department of Transport, but they are housed at the South African Civil Aviation Authority, and the CAA basically manages them. The challenge you have with that setup is that the CAA almost every time becomes a party to the investigation because of the decision that they make for oversight. And the relationship between the accident investigation unit and the CAA must be quite clearly split and apart as such. Now, formulating the accident safety investigation board is as follows. Similar to the licensing councils, we have the accident investigation board for one full-time member, and they'll convene meetings 12 times a year at minimum. And supporting them in terms of the everyday operational role, you'll have the director of investigation and you'll have accident incident investigators. We currently do have the capacity, but they sit at the CAA. When the act is proclaimed as such, then those particular individuals will move within the accident safety investigation board and continue with their functions in terms of investigators.
Okay, Mr. Collins, that was the question I was about to ask, but you still have quite a few more slides to do with the accident, with assets. I don't think we want to just, because I was going to ask you currently how obviously we can conduct accident investigation. And the key point you're making is that the importance of acceleration within the CAA and this investigation board. And this is a requirement.
it's a requirement in terms of the convention. Yes. Every state must have an independent board for aircraft accidents and investigation. Okay. Then in terms of arrangements, we provided for agreements between the board and the director, which is the director of the CAA. The board and director may agree on the secondment staff of the director to the board as such and any other related matter. Conflict of interest must be avoided at all times. The board to enter into agreements with the minister responsible for departments, providing for coordination of activities, and providing for procedures should conflicting interests arise between the board and the department as such.
Okay, let's just dwell there, because having said that you will now separate the two,
yes,
you're now making an arrangement which allows the conflict. Would that be a one or transitional component of the conflict you're talking about, or is it,
Because of the, and this is a global issue, because of the capacity constraints globally,
yes,
and there may be an incident that has come about,
yes,
and the board requires special technical capacity, and the CAA normally has the capacity,
yes,
there might be a secondment arrangement reached, but with a very clear separation agreement that says, fine, the person moves across,
yes,
investigates the incident within the ambit of the board,
yes,
and then after that, it can go back to the CAA,
okay,
as such. Yes.
Which makes sense, because one hopes that there aren't lots of
ongoing
regulatory functions.
Absolutely. Yeah, and on that note, Mr. Chairman, I think we have one of the safest skies, because we have never had a commercial jetliner crash on South African soil to date.
Yes.
So,
and you say that this is international practice, that the secondment arrangement is one that wouldn't be peculiar to.
No, I think we can also take our cue from Rene, because with all his experience and he's been heading a number of these divisions.
Yes.
Rene, you may insist. Yeah.
So the emphasis is when you have a big accident, you really need supporting staff, and that is
we'll ask the CIA to support your people,
yeah,
but you expect the CIA to relieve them from their duties in COVID. And they function as an accident investigator for that period until the accident is completed, and they return to continue.
And the line of command is also very clear.
Very clear, they have to be relieved.
Yeah. And is that made clear in the bill that we've got?
Well, when we talk about the may agree on the secondment stuff, that will come out in the actual agreement. And we also
intend of the agreement to the clarity of these lines. This is the key.
Yes.
strategic issue. But the flag is the matter.
Yes, because then that is why, Mr. Chairman, we also provide in terms of the conflict of interest element that it must be avoided. So it's very clear up there that, you know, the conflict of interest issue has to be flagged. And I think also in the agreement,
the general conflict of interest. Well, it's that too, but it's specifically the conflict of interest between board and authority.
Yes. The remuneration of staff of the board, staff to be remunerated as determined by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And then the independence and impartiality of the board to carry out powers, duties and functions subject only to this act and the convention, and its involvement in investigation in any interest is held is not allowed. The function of the Aviation Safety Investigation Board, it will investigate aircraft acts and aircraft incidents in compliance with Annex 13 of the convention. It advises on safety recommendations prior to the completion of any investigation. It oversees and controls the performance of functions and activities of persons appointed by. It submits the final report to the minister within 3 months of completion of an investigation. It submits final reports to all recipient states in compliance with Annex 13 to the convention regarding aircraft accident or aircraft incident investigated by the board. It monitors the implementation of safety recommendations as issued by contracting states.
Okay, how does that latter point monitor? CAA is doing a similar job or not at all?
Okay. The investigation board, bearing in mind that they would investigate an accident or they would come up with a report as such, and let's say, for example, the report has highlighted a particular issue. Being a contracting state, we have a seat at ACAIO, and we are quite... we can quite easily determine whether safety recommendations are being implemented globally. And that is one of the plus factors in this setup in terms of its end objective, is that when an accident happens and when a report is produced and safety recommendations are made, that must be circulated or must be available to all member states. So one could then monitor and see its implementation as well.
That was my question, though. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm saying I'm still looking at the interface between the CAA and the investigation board. And with monitoring implementation of safety recommendations, where does it fall? So it's saying here it falls under the investigation board.
Okay.
Is that not the sort of thing that the CAA is doing?
I'll hand over to the most competent person to answer them, Mr. Chairman, the Commissioner for the CAA.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. Chair, in this case, what it is that following an accident or just following investigations, the board will make safety recommendations, which should be implemented by the CAA, either through changes in legislation and regulations or by changes in practice. What this particular section requires is that the board will monitor whether or not the CAA has in fact carried out those recommendations, so that there is a feedback loop.
Okay. So again, when we get to the exact wording, it's something that we would need to just make sure that your explanation is clear in law and doesn't result in a series of curveballs or whatever. This is always a thing that I need to watch out. But okay, I mean, at least we understand the principle.
Then in terms of the powers of the board investigators, the board will investigate aircraft accidents, aircraft incidents. It will determine its own staff establishment having regard to available funds, to make rules for internal procedures for the investigation of aircraft accidents and incidents, to delegate the investigation of aircraft accidents and aircraft incidents to other contracting states as per Annex 13 to the convention, to establish an aircraft accident aircraft incident reporting system. It will institute or defend any legal action, summon and examine witnesses under oath, and summon any person to give evidence. The powers of the Director of Investigation, he has exclusive authority to direct the conduct of investigations on behalf of the board. Investigators have unrestricted access to aircraft involved in an aircraft accident or aircraft incident, as well as to all documents which may be necessary for the investigation. The investigators may compile reports in connection with the investigation. They may obtain information from any person, summon and examine witnesses under oath. They have unrestricted access to and control over all relevant evidence. They may require a person to submit to a medical examination, may require a physician, if so authorized by a patient, to provide information, and may cause an autopsy to be carried out. seized and seized here by investigators, Section 33. Investigators may only in execution of Section 32 search and seize any property or item, enter and search a place for any item and secure the safe keeping of the item seized. Okay. Power to test item seized, return thereof and certificate and public inquiry covered in Section 34, 35, 36 and 37 respectfully. The investigator may cause test including destruction of an item to be conducted. The owner of the item may be present at testing of such item. Items seized must be returned to the owner or person from whom it was seized as soon as possible. The owner or person from whom an item was seized may apply to a court to have the item returned, public inquiry held when deemed necessary, and a certificate of appointment may be requested of the investigator. I'm going to pause here and explain in layman terms because we had great debate over this because it's constitutional issues. Okay. If an aircraft lands in your backyard and crashes into your swimming pool as such, one would expect that to be the scene of an accident, to be cordoned off, and investigators will have unrestricted access to that accident scene to conduct the investigation. Obviously, they may seize certain items belonging to the property owner. For example, if the aircraft went into your vehicle, that's part of the accident scene. They need to do the test, find out what measurements, etc., etc. And we can understand that. It does not allow the investigator to then go into your lounge and take your plasma screen. And we've been quite extreme in defining this because that was the fear factor. That by having this in there, the investigators have an open field day in the person's property. It does not. But let's say that the investigator does take a particular item off your property and you want to seek a remedy to get that item returned. We have made provision for one to go to court and to say, fine, that item should not have been seized. It's mine. It's not part of the accident. I want it returned. And the court may then determine upon it. As such. Okay. Notification of department of occurrence of aircraft accident, aircraft incident, covered in Section 38. When a department is notified of an aircraft accident, aircraft incident, that department must provide the board with full particulars thereof and advise the board of any investigation it plans to conduct. Notification of a minister having interest in an aircraft accident or aircraft incident. When a board is notified of an aircraft accident or aircraft incident, it must provide particulars thereof to any minister responsible for a department having an interest. A good example would be Minister of Defense, the Minister of Department of Environment and Tourism, because these are directly related departments to this particular industry. We also advise the minister of that department of any investigation it plans to conduct. Okay, attendance and removal of observers. These are observed in terms of investigation. Subject to conditions provided by the board, a person may attend as an observer at an investigation. Such person may be removed as an observer from an investigation if the observer has a conflict of interest that impedes the conduct of the investigation. Sections 41 and 42 deals with the report on completion of investigation and manner of dealing with representations and the rights of affected parties. On completion of investigation, the board must prepare and make available to the public a report on its findings indicating safety deficiencies. We must note here that this report won't say XYZ is to be blamed. Okay. Before making public such report, a copy of the draft report will be sent to the minister, each minister and person who has a direct interest in the findings, and must give that minister or person an opportunity to make representations within no less than 60 days. An interim report must be provided upon request by a minister of a department having an interest in the investigation. Representations received must be considered before preparing a final report. Representation must be used by the board if considered necessary in the interest of aviation safety. Now, once again, we just want to caution that in no way is this designed so that ministers may influence the outcome of the report in any particular direction. What it allows for an opportunity for other departments provide input which they would deem substantial in giving more information, providing more information to the investigators to derive a final report that is truly reflective of what has transpired as such. Section 43 and 44, notification of findings and the minister's right to respond. The board must, during its investigation, notify a minister or any person having an interest in its findings that the matter requires urgent attention. And in completion of its investigation, notify a minister or a person who has an interest in its findings of any safety deficiencies together with recommendations. A minister who is notified of the finding of the board must, within 90 days, advise the board of any proposed action to be taken in response to finding the recommendations, or provide written reasons to the board if no action will be taken. Okay. Section 45 deals with delegation of powers. The board is allowed to...
Advise the board of any proposed action. That would be any proposed action as advised by the board.
Yes.
Okay.
Section 45, the board may delegate powers to duties except powers to make rules and recommendations. Okay. On-board recording. These are the on-board data recordings of aircraft that we speak of. Okay. Contents of an on-board recording is privileged. However, an on-board recording that relates to aircraft accidents or aircraft incidents must be released to an investigator. The board must not communicate or permit to be communicated any portion of an on-board recording that is unrelated to the cause or contributing factors. Court or judicial inquest may order evidence relating to onboard recordings to be given if in public interest or if proper administration or justice outweighs privilege attached to such recording.
Can you explain the background to that?
Okay.
I have a sense of
it. Go back,
please.
Sorry. Alright. Does any onboard recording?
The intent is that recordings should not be made public, and as it would ease the acceptance thereof by representative unions of pilots, etc., who consider that conversations in cockpits are privileged and should not be disclosed. So the emphasis to obtain what has happened in a cockpit and to be able that a pilot does not pull the circuit breaker or override the cockpit voice recorder, as such information is readily available to investigators without the fear of interference of it being not available during the investigation itself. So that's the emphasis, and it's an international pressure and supported by the International Civil Aviation Organization that this information should be released and not made public.
So they're discussing their girlfriends or whatever.
You
want that to be recorded, not so that you can make it public and embarrassing, but
not
the course of that discussion, something of relevance.
What has happened in the cockpit here, rather than them flying something and pulling circuit breakers and there is no recording available to the investigator.
So that's the trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
politicians would have the same cover.
It's privileged. Okay. Sections 53 to 57 deal with the communication record and statement of claim. Communication record must not be used against a person in legal or disciplinary proceedings. A statement will not be used against a person who made it in any legal or disciplinary proceeding except in a prosecution for perjury. Courts or inquests may require evidence to be given relating to the statement if public interest or proper administration of justice outweighs the privilege attached to the statement. Sections 58 to 60 deals with the reporting of aircraft accidents and aircraft incidents. The board may make rules for mandatory or voluntary reporting of aircraft accidents or aircraft incidents. Identity of persons who make the report to the board may be protected. Report under voluntary system may not be used against the person who made the report in any legal or disciplinary proceedings. Okay. Appearance and opinions of the investigators covered in section 61-62. The investigator is not competent or compellable to appear as witness except before a judicial inquest and if ordered by court. The opinion of the investigator is not admissible in evidence, in legal, disciplinary, or other proceedings. Okay. Rules are covered in section 63. The board may, subject to approval by a minister, make rules prescribing the manner in which it exercises its powers, duties, and functions, regulating the keeping of records, and regarding rules and procedures for public inquiries. Section 64 to 65 covers the offences and evidence. Any person who, without lawful excuse, resists or obstructs a member of the board or investigator, or knowingly gives false or misleading information, is guilty of an offence. No person may refuse or fail to produce information to an investigator, and no person may refuse to submit to a medical examination, but such information remains privileged. Transitional arrangements and liability. A matter that is being investigated or has been investigated, but a report has not been made by the CAA when this act comes into force, shall, when this act comes into force, be taken up and continued by the board. Members of the board, appointed staff, accredited representatives, expert and advisor, not personally liable by virtue of any report or finding made in good faith. Okay, the next section deals with the Civil Aviation Authority itself. The establishment and objects are covered in section 70 and 71. The CA is a juristic person. The objects of the CA are to control, regulate civil aviation safety and security, oversee safety and security matters in civil aviation industry, oversee functioning and development of civil aviation industry, promote civil aviation safety and security. Mr. Chairman, previously, as I said, many years ago, security wasn't an issue in aviation, and you read our old act always refers to safety, safety, safety. But as we are now moving into an era where security is of primary importance, that's why it clearly starts out in the act. Okay. The function of the CAA is to conduct safety and security oversight of civil aviation by developing, promoting regulatory requirements, technical aviation safety and security standards, developing enforcement strategies to secure compliance with aviation safety and security standards, issue certificates and licenses, etc., conducting aviation industry surveillance, assessment of safety and security related decisions, overseeing and regulating flight inspections of navigational aids to aviation, and conducting reviews of civil aviation safety and security systems. Safety and security related functions are as follows: encouraging acceptance by the industry of its obligation to maintain high standards of aviation safety, safety and security education and training programs, to advise and awareness of importance of aviation safety and security to the industry, communication with all interested parties, they administer this act, they make recommendations to the minister regarding conclusion of any international agreement, and investigate aircraft accident and aircraft incident that the board has determined not to investigate. Okay, now, maybe I should clarify that before I question this, but why would the board not want to investigate certain accident incidents? I think we need to understand that a number of the aircraft accidents we have are general aviation, which is a small aircraft that may have just landed and taxied off a runway into a tree or something, you know. And one does not want to get the accident safety investigation board sort of put into day-to-day, you know, petty incidents as such. So those petty incidences, while I deem them to be petty in context, the CAA may decide to investigate, and the board can then ask for a report as such on the investigation. The staff and the funding are covered in section 73 and 74. The director of the CAA appoints.
So let's just stop on that last, because we need to keep, I think, this monitoring this interface between the board and,
okay,
and the CAA. So in section 72, we're saying the CAA would do it if there's an active determination not to investigate by that. They have to wait for that active determination.
Yeah, because normally the ASIF, as you call it, it's easier to call it that.
Okay.
ASIF will,
I forget what it's.
Yeah, ASIF will deal with serious accidents and incidents, where there's fatalities, injuries, massive damage to property, damage to aircraft, and get into those kind of accidents which are quite very technical in nature and needs to have a recommendation to prevent such occurrence. The CAA, nothing prevents the CAA from investigating a similar incident for prosecution purposes. Because the CAA may then investigate and decide, oh, hang on a second, the person that maintained this aircraft was not competent. So we need to prosecute the person. So there's a very clear delineation in terms of roles. Whilst the ASIF is investigating an incident, it's for the no blame. CAA may investigate a similar incident and apportion blame. On the same note, the CAA may also investigate a number of incidents which ASIF hasn't decided to investigate, but ASIF would inform the CAA we're not investigating those incidents. And the reason may be one, from a resource point of view, that we're not going to go into every small incident. The CAA has the resources, let them investigate it, because, as I said, the damage wasn't as, can be quantified as extreme. There was no fatalities, there were no injuries. So all the CAA is doing is to investigate it, one, prevent the occurrence, also to find out, is there anyone responsible that contributed to this particular incident as such.
It sounds arbitrary. Is there no possibility of a categorization?
Yes, thank you, Honourable Member. There is. And that is why it is with spelled out clearly somewhere in Act that the accident investigation board, the ASIF, will determine what category of aircraft accident incident they will investigate. So there is a very clear cut-off line in terms of how far they would extend their powers to.
So my point is, would that be made clear in advance, maybe in the form of what regulations or, you know, so that we know in advance? It's not something that will be determined, you know, on an ongoing basis.
Honourable Member, you rightly pointed out, it will be made out well clear in advance in regulation.
Again, we can come back to the detail, but obviously we've put flagging areas that we need to look at more closely when we come to the text. But in the actual bill, it's on page 36, it's almost the same wording as the problem of judge. Forgive us, let's start the flag areas where we need to be thoughtful about. In a sort of general way, it's kind of clear, I think, that you're not going to have investigation board, like that. The investigation board, you're not going to have it running off every, it might have the capacity, and you don't want it to have that capacity. You want it there to deal with the serious thing. Now, like I said, but many of these things need to be looked at nonetheless, and the PA has more resources and so on. But first of all, who's going to pick up these events? It's going to be typically, there's an obligation to report every incident on the part of the operator and the operator in particular, presumably, who may or may not be inclined to report it, but will be picked up also by airport authorities or whatever. And the CAA would become what the first entity would be. So the obligation is to report to the CAA. I slipped my little light flag, and I ran into a tree like this, and I see it also, and ran some of the forces with that obligation. But the CAA is the recipient of the airport. Okay. Then what happens? If because here it says, and under K it says that the investigation board determines the investigation officer. Is that a case by case determination, or is it a determination in principle? These are the kinds of things we'll look at, or is it both? I mean, obviously there's a kind of general categorization of what is serious and not serious, and we know that's an authority in other areas, in terms of the definition of serious injury for the person of the road accident. So we are going to draw the line between serious and non-serious, and in the end there's a degree of arbitrariness about it. But so how does the investigating board come on board?
Chair, thank you. I can actually spell that quite clearly, which are accidents that have to be reported to ICAO. And there are specific categories. For example, if the undercarriage of an airliner is damaged and parts have to be replaced, that then becomes a notifiable incident. I imagine what will happen is that we will set up rules along those lines, that wherever it's a notifiable incident, which has to go to ICAO, that will be the prerogative of the Accident Safety Investigation Board. And other incidents which aren't of such a nature will be held will be dealt with by the CAA. I think in every case, the accident itself will have to be reported to the investigation board, but using a predetermined methodology, there will be a tacit agreement that only if it is of a certain category will the board then take over the investigation. Otherwise, the CAA will handle it in the normal course of events.
In what you said, I know there was a couple of I imagine what we'll do is, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering whether we don't need to be a little bit clearer in the legislation itself and not leave it to imagination entirely.
I'm probably worrying about something that in fact it might not be a problem, but our experience in this interface between entities is something that we would need to look at seriously. Because that's where we get tension and potential problems. I'm not sure if this fraternity that had no tension, everything might seem to be right to a problem, but we then say that we would need to.
Che, what we've noticed in many countries is that the investigation board and the CAA authority will normally conclude an MOU clearly outlining the relationship, particularly where there's a parallel investigation that takes place, taking note that the board investigates purely in terms of finding the root cause without apportioning blame or any legal liability, whereas the CAA may conduct a parallel investigation to apportion blame and to carry out enforcement. So, although it hasn't been specifically put into a regulation, in the regulations that will be formulated as a result of the passing of the Act, this is one issue that will have to be put in place.
Staff and funding, section 73 and 74.
The director appoints staff to enable CAA to carry out its functions. The CAA is funded from regulated charges, fees, and levies. Loans, money is received in terms of the South African Aviation Authority Levies Act and levies on the supply of aircraft fuel. If the use of name and the conflict of interest, restriction on the use of the name South African Aviation Authority, no other party or person may use the name SACAA. You want to highlight it today?
Mr. Chair, perhaps could just go back to the previous issue. If you have regard to section 30, subsection 1E on page 23 of the bill.
31.
E. It specifically determines categories of aircraft accidents and incidents that should be investigated by the board. So, if one has regard to that specific section, you'll find that the board will then lay down the rules as Mr. Yolande referred to. I think that should deal with any issues that might arise in the interface between the two, the CIA and the board.
As rightfully pointed out, I think also the issue of discretion needs to be ironed out, and that goes down to the MOU where it's clearly spelled out. So there's got to be an executional document that says you can do 1, 3, 4. And I think that's the chairman's concern, that it's not clearly spelled out, but we can address that. Okay, on the use of name, we've covered the South African Aviation Authority's restriction on the use of the name. And any person appointed to perform a function in terms of this Act or regulations must disclose to the director details of aspects which may compromise independence in carrying out duties and functions. Limitation of liability and ministerial orders are covered in section 77 and 78. No employee of the CAA is liable for anything done in good faith in exercise of its power or duty in terms of this Act. After consultation with the CAA, the minister may require the CAA to act in the interest of aviation safety and security or to discharge or sustain international obligation, and in doing so he may present an order to that effect. Okay. The next section is on the South African Aviation Authority Board. Before we proceed with the presentation, I just want to iron out an issue here, Jim. We work from a premise of the past assessment done by the FAA. And
I'm wondering if it is part of we might proceed or not, but there's quite a lot of background noise.
Yeah.
But I am hearing you.
Okay. Okay. So we work on pretty much of the assessment done by the FAA in towards the end of last year in December, as well as the ACAIO audit that was done. And there is no correct approach on this particular issue in terms of the CAA and its institutional arrangements globally. Okay, but what is the requirement is that the South African Federation Authority as a juristic person having a director appointed must have a direct reporting line to the political head and must be able to execute its duties without any fear or prejudice as such. So in doing so, the requirement is that the director should not report to the board on a safety issue or request the board's opinion on a safety issue before the director decides to act. He must be given a free hand to act immediately, and I think that's the principle being applied. Now, in terms of our own South African legislation, we have the PFMA, and this being an entity of the state, normally has to subscribe to the PFMA as such. The PFMA allows you latitude. You can either have a board or you can have an entity that operates without a board. Now, having said that, one needs to take into cognizance that the South African Civil Aviation Authority is not a business, and I'm going to quote examples to the likes of the Air Force Company South Africa, where it operates for profit and it goes into investments and capital expenditure sector, etc. This is an entity that has a very clear mandate, and its mandate is to provide oversight for safety and security, and it's a regulatory of operation. Okay? So it's very, very clear cut in terms of what they can do and what they cannot do. Boards are normally appointed for where the strategic direction in terms of growing the business, etc., etc. In putting this bill together and taking our cue from the findings of the audits of last year, we drafted this particular section of the bill where the functions of the board are clearly spelled out more on corporate governance and on financial controls of the entity. And on the same token, we have clearly defined the responsibilities of the director in terms of safety and security oversight. So I'm sure the committee will have questions and we well prepared to answer them, but this is an area where there is no clear cut principle to be applied across.
Okay. Our members care about what's just been said.
Maybe just expand a little. I mean, when you say that there are international examples of civil aviation authorities which have boards and which don't have boards.
That's correct.
That's one point that you're making. The second point is whether they have boards or not. The international ICAO requirements are that the director of safety.
The director of the authority
must have in terms of security matters and safety matters, must have a direct reporting line, i.e. Must be able to bypass the board in terms of recommendations or interventions required in, at least in those categories of things, a direct reporting line to the political head, i.e. in our case it would be the minister. So what you're alerting us to is that we've got a board, and currently in the bill that we've got in front of us, the board is still there, but we're making a provision for the director to bypass the board in respect of safety and security matters.
That's correct. The way the bill is spelled out, it clearly outlines what the board is responsible for and says you corporate governance, etc., etc., and tells you in terms of what the director is responsible for. The challenge one may have, and given hindsight of how boards operate, is boards presume that they're in control of the entire entity.
We've noticed that.
And that's the point I'm trying to flag.
Okay.
So,
is to think about whether we need a board at all for an entity which is a regulatory entity and of a safety and security kind, not a commercial entity or a corporatized entity like AXA or Transnet or whatever. Okay, we'll certainly keep that in mind, I think, as we proceed. I noticed also we've got a submission from Weber Rensel, which we'll distribute. I think they've asked for time to upgrade their intervention on behalf of the Aviation Association. And this is an issue that they're raising as well. So that will also present us with an opportunity as a committee to think for ourselves, as it were, because, I mean, the bill comes from Cabinet, but now it's in front of us, and it's our job to, we can do whatever we want, actually, with whether we can decide to throw it all out or amend it quite substantially. So we'll certainly, thanks for alerting us to this issue, and we'll certainly look at it. I mean, but okay, let's proceed with what is in front of us.
Okay, the establishment and the objects of the Civil Aviation Authority Board are covered in Section 79 and 80. Basically, it states that the board is established. The board determines, oversees, implements, and revises corporate governance structures and HR policies of the CAA, and it sets strategic goals for the South African Civil Aviation Authority. The functions are covered in Section 81, where it clearly spells out it determines remuneration policy of allowances and other service benefits of CAA employees, provides guidance to the director in respect of strategic goals, provides annual report, acts as the accounting authority for the CAA, and it may appoint committees to advise it on the exercise of powers and functions. And when we talk about committees, we're talking about the remuneration committee, audit committee, etc., etc. Appointment of members, 7 members, 1 to be a non-executive chairperson, appointed for 3 years, eligible for reappointment for 1 further term. Okay, and this is similar in terms of our thought process. When you look at the ASIP, we don't want to have people that hold 5-6 terms and become kings of the empire as such. Okay. Then one must be the minister specified in office in the department, and then one must be a person suitable expertise in corporate governance, HR management. 2 may be people experienced in civil aviation matters. The director is an ex-officio member of the board, and members are part-time members and hold office for 3 years and may be reappointed. Members only appointed after nominations have been requested. Members must have experience in international domestic civilization, corporate governance, financial management, business, environmental management, economic analysis, aviation infrastructure. Can we just go back to you? We have omitted one bullet point, and I'm flagging this. Given the emphasis placed on human resources, we would like to insert that. I think that is an issue that we have omitted on that slide. Meeting the remuneration of members, covered in Section 83 and 84. Meetings to be held at time and place to be determined by chairperson. 3 members form a quorum. The chairperson presides at all meetings. Appointed members receive remuneration as determined by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. Sections 85 and 86 covers the removal of member conflict of interest. A member vacates office immediately if is convicted of specific offences. Without authorization, discloses information gained as a result of membership, is or become a political office bearer, has any time been removed from an office or trust on account of misconduct, is relieved by office by minister in accordance with the Act. The minister may relieve members if the member failed to comply with performance agreement and failed to correct such failure, or if there are any potential conflict of interest which has to be disclosed immediately. Section 87 and 88 cover the performance agreement with the minister, and as outlined, the board is not responsible for the safety and security oversight part of the business. This is restricted to business and financial plan. The minister and the board enters into written performance agreements relating to the minister's requirements in respect of efficiency and achievement of objects, principles to be followed in respect of business planning, and the protection of financial soundness of the CA board. The CA board must submit an annual business and financial plan to the minister. Sections 89 and 90 cover the CFMA and annual report. The CFMA applies to the board, an annual report to be submitted to the minister consisting of the normal financial statements, report by the auditor of the CAA board and the financial position of CAA, and confirming measures and procedures for the proper application of sound, economic, efficient and effective management. Then we move on to the director of the Civil Aviation Authority. Okay. Now, I'm going to pause here and just recap some history. Aviation Act of 1962 talks of a commissioner appointed by the minister. The commissioner is ultimately responsible for the Aviation Act as well as all regulations that flow out of it. The SACA Act of 1998 talks of a board, and the board appoints the CEO, and the CEO is responsible for the authority. So one could understand
the challenge you had in terms of the audit and assessment last year, who really is in charge of this organization? Now, we did our benchmark exercise and tried to establish what is the requirement for running this entity. And the requirement is to have a technically competent person that heads up the South African Submission Authority, and that person globally now the norm is to term as director. So ideally what we have done is we have collapsed both the previous CEO's role and the commissioner's role into one, and going forward in the new bill is termed director. The minister appoints the director. The minister must have regard to management and technical knowledge in aviation related fields, special skills, qualification, administrative expertise, any other factor which minister considers appropriate. I'm going to pause this because I need to flag this so that in 50 years from now we don't have a situation where there is another minister that reads this in a different way and appoints someone that works in an airport as a check-in agent and believes he has aviation experience. The aviation experience we're talking about and technical knowledge we're talking about is someone, in all due respect to Captain Colin Durant, that has at least 4 candy stripes on the shoulders, has a number of flying hours, is technically competent and understands the industry and is in a position that can execute as per the regulations that have been drafted. The director holds office for a period not exceeding 5 years. The director may be reappointed. The director holds office on a full-time basis, and the director must be a South African citizen. The duties of the director are covered in Section 92. The director manages and is the head of SACA's administration. The director is solely and directly accountable to the minister in respect of civil aviation safety and security oversight issues. The director is accountable to the SACA board in respect of implementation of governance policies. Section 93 deals with the responsibilities again. The director is responsible for safety and security oversight functions, performs any functions and exercises any power assigned to the director in terms of performance agreement, and is responsible for submission of an annual report in conjunction with the CAA board. The powers of the director and assignment and such delegation are covered in Section 94-95. The director may designate one or more persons in service of the CAA as inspectors or authorized officers, and persons not in service of CAA as authorized persons. May limit powers of authorized officers, inspectors or authorized persons, may appoint authorized security personnel to render security services. This is very important for the director executing functions. He's a one-man person. His arms and legs are the inspectors. So for him to be able to fulfill the obligation, he needs to empower and designate those powers of 2 persons in service of C as inspectors or authorized officers. Now, when you say person not in service of C as authorized persons, we're looking at the capacity issue of the industry. The director may find people on an ad hoc basis that he can designate particular functions to say go and execute. We also inserted the issue of the acting director, because we all know that people take leave, get sick or go abroad with this particular industry. So where it's not exceeding 30 days, the director may, in the event of director's absence from the Republic or inability to fulfill duties, appoint a member of staff of the CA to act as director, and that period of appointment as acting director may not exceed 30 days. Where it exceeds 30 days, the minister appoints the acting director in absence of the director exceeding 30 days, and the acting director may not act for more than 12 months. Consultation, conflict of interest are covered in Section 97-98. The director must, in performance of functions, endeavour to consult with relevant persons and bodies. All conflict of interest are prohibited. The director may not hold direct or indirect financial interest in civil aviation activity without prior approval of the minister. Performance agreements are covered in Section 99-100. The director may not carry on any activity inconsistent with the duties or obligations under this Act, and the minister and director must enter into a performance agreement. Okay, we then move over to the monitoring and enforcement of the regulatory compliance by the CAA, which are covered in Section 101. An authorized officer, authorized person, inspector may, without a warrant, enter aircraft, place or premises, inspect, examine objects and make copies from any book or document that such person believes on reasonable grounds contains information relevant to the administration of the Act. May enter without a warrant a private dwelling. A private dwelling may only be entered without a warrant if believed. An object may be destroyed, tampered with, or disposed of if a warrant is obtained first. We must understand the nature of this business. It's not just putting aircraft in the air and flying aircraft in the air. There's a lot of technical competencies on the ground. We have aircraft maintenance organizations. I wouldn't want to quote any particular example, but practice has shown that when inspectors do go to certain maintenance organizations, documents do disappear. So this provision is very important to allow for the safeguard of safety oversight of the industry. In the grounding of aircraft and closing of facility, when you talk of closing of facility, we're talking of maintenance organizations, we're talking of airports, aerodromes, etc. These are covered in section 102. If an aircraft is intended or likely to be flown under circumstances contravening this act or will cause imminent danger, an authorized officer or inspector may ground any aircraft or close any aviation-related facility. The director may lift the grounding order when satisfied that the act is complied with. Prohibition on exercising of privileges are covered in section 103. The authorized officer or inspector may prohibit the holder of aviation certificate, permit or authorization to exercise such privilege if the act is likely to be contravened or there is an imminent danger to person in aircraft or person property on the ground. Okay. Now, we all know we have PAJA in the country in terms of the Commercial Administrative Justice Act, and a number of the actions undertaken by the CAA are administrative in nature. So we made provision in the new bill for an administrative appeals committee, and the reason being is the old bill spoke about appealing to the minister, and we all know the minister's job is not to hear appeals. This is a technical business and you need to hear the appeals rather seriously, and more importantly be able to apply your mind on the technical platform as such. So in terms of the appeals committee, we got appeals against decisions of authorized officers, authorized persons, inspectors. They are covered in section 104 and 105. The decision has the same meaning as a sign in PAJA. An agreed person may lodge written appeals for the director first within 30 days. The director within 3 days may amend, withdraw, or make a new decision. The person aggrieved by the decision of the director may within 5 days appeal to the appeals committee. Appeal against refusal, cancellation of medical certificate. Now there are two appeals processes here. One is a normal appeal in terms of, let's say, maintenance organizations, technical issues, etc., etc. And then, given the nature of the industry, which places a high emphasis on medical condition of, let's say, your cockpit crew, there's an appeal process for medical conditions. Okay? This deals with the medical conditions. The applicant for or hold up a medical certificate who feels aggrieved by a decision to cancel a medical certificate, a decision declaring him or her unfit or temporarily unfit, or endorsement made on the medical certificate may appeal to the director within 60 days. The director, assisted by at least two medical practitioners, one of which must have experience in aviation medicine, will consider this appeal. The appeal must be considered within 60 days of receipt thereof, and if still not satisfied, the appellant may appeal to the High Court. The appeal against the decision of the director and minister are covered in section 107-108. A person aggrieved by the decision taken by the director, excluding that decision on medical certificate, may appeal to the appeals committee within 30 days. A person as to the act who feels aggrieved by a decision of the minister may appeal to the High Court. Composition of appeals committee, covered in section 109, the minister appoints appeals committee. The appeals committee consists of persons with not less than 10 years experience as an attorney or advocate and two other persons. They are appointed on a part-time basis, must have technical knowledge, experience, aviation-related fields, special skills, qualification, experience, aviation required. It's not one appeal committee as you're reading in the bill, the number of appeals committee. Reason why we did that was, one, from an efficiency factor point of view, knowing that this is quite a money-driven industry, that if someone, a decision has been taken against, they must have the opportunity to have the appeal heard as quickly as possible and decision as quickly as possible.
Okay. As a matter of interest, how many appeals? I mean, what do we want? I mean, obviously, it can vary, but...
Yes, they can vary. And for the nature
practice,
of the...
What is the likelihood?
You normally get about 10 appeals a month, given practice.
Sure, they vary. The ones that have gone to the minister this year, I think we've had about 6 in total to the minister. That internal appeal, but it's nowhere near that. There's what happens is that an inspector will normally make a decision with regard to an enforcement action. that's discussed with our legal team. If they are concerned that it might have repercussions, they'll discuss it with me, and then we may decide to carry on with enforcement action or water it down or drop it altogether. So we actually try and put in place a process where we don't get to an appeal stage, if we've actually considered the enforcement action thoroughly before we carry it out.
But the commission also knows better. People will appeal, and I think that's the nature of the business, that we do have appeal, so we do cater for this. And also
I was just trying to get a sense of, you know,
the volume.
I'm dealing with 100 manual,
and
it's not
the right. And also, Mr. Chairman, the nature of the appeal, you get a simple appeal, and as rightly pointed out, can be resolved, and then you also get one of a very technical nature that needs to have one's mind applied 100%. Okay, we are still 6109. Okay, yes. The person having direct or indirect personal interest in outcome for the appeal may be disqualified as a member of such committee. A member holds office for 3 years and is eligible for reappointment. The minister may terminate the period of office of member if performance is unsatisfactory or if the member is unable to perform the functions effectively. The conditions of service and quorum in the meeting are covered in section 110 and 111. Conditions of service are prescribed by the minister with approval of Minister of Finance. All members of appeal committee constitute a quorum. Procedure at appeal is determined by chairperson of the appeals committee. The chairperson may summon any person having information concerning the subject of the hearing and call any person as a witness. The decision and general provisions are covered in section 112 and 113. The appeal committee may confirm, vary, or set aside a decision. The decision of the appeals committee must be made in writing within 20 days of the hearing of the appeal. The chairperson must maintain a record of proceedings. No person is excused from complying with the Act on the ground that an appeal is pending. Appeals against decision of appeal committee and administrative work are covered in section 114 and 115. Any person affected by decision of an appeal committee may appeal to the High Court. The administrative work of appeals committees are performed by the employees of the department. Procedures for identifying, notifying of differences and issues of exemptions are covered in section 116 and 117. Procedures for identifying and notifying of differences are prescribed. The director may exempt a person or body from compliance with the Act on specific conditions. Exemption may not be granted for periods longer than 180 days, possible to extend for a further 180 days. Okay. Maybe does the chairperson committee require an explanation on what may require an exemption? The thing is,
Chair, we write regulations that cover probably 95% of the cases that we deal with. But in many instances, I'll give you an example. There may be a specific part on an aeroplane which requires replacement within a certain time period, within 100 hours of flying or 1,000 hours of flying. Very often what happens is at the time that this part has to be replaced, the operator places an order with the manufacturer and the manufacturer cannot supply. At that point in time, the operator will go to the manufacturer of the aircraft or the engine, whichever it may be, and will get a no technical objection for an exemption to this particular act to be carried out. They then submit the exemption process to the CAA. We have a review board that sits. They consider the submission. And if they're satisfied that an equivalent level of safety is obtained, they will then recommend to the commissioner or the director that the exemption be granted for a specific period of time. And this happens on a regular basis.
But it's not automatic. Other way, the fact that the part isn't in
stock is
not enough, a good enough reason. There still needs to be, as you say.
Quite right. We normally work on the principle of an equivalent level of safety has to be maintained.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and then in compliance and execute the convention, that's marshalling signals, interception, maneuvers, and orders. South African aircraft must comply with marshalling signals, interception, orders, and maneuvers issued by any state. Aircraft in South African airspace must comply with marshalling signals, interception, order, or maneuver issued by an authority, not the, it's an error there in terms of SA aircraft. This is important, especially as we're heading towards 2010. It's in the existing act, but I'm just flagging it. That you don't want someone flying to an uncontrolled airspace, there should be allowances for intercepting and redirecting the aircraft as such. Transfer of functions and duties, which is Article 83 bis, is covered in Section 119. When an aircraft registered in a contracting state is operated by a lease agreement or charter, the minister may, by agreement with such state, transfer to it all or part of its functions and duties. The director must, under specific circumstances, recognize validity of licenses and certificates. It should read as follows. Any aircraft within South African airspace must comply with any marshalling signal, interception order or maneuvers issued in compliance with Annex 2 of the Convention. So the word that will be delivered is by any South African aircraft. Next slide, Johan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then in terms of offences and penalties covered in Section 120, any person who on board an aircraft in flight without lawful reason seizes or exercises control of an aircraft, commits an act of violence, willfully interferes with any member of the crew, destroys or causes damage to aircraft, places an aircraft a device which is likely to destroy the aircraft, destroys or damages air navigation facilities, communicates information which he or she knows to be false, places at or in any airport any device which is calculated to endanger, injure, or kill any person, commits an act at an airport which is likely to cause serious injury, performs any other act which jeopardizes or may jeopardize an operation of an air carrier, take to an airport, good order and discipline of the airport, is guilty of an offense.
Okay, let's hold on to that. As I go back to the first of the slides dealing with Section 120, communicate information which he or she knows to be false. I know what you can do, but could be rather well. Let's have a look at how that works actually. Okay, we can add, thereby endangering the safety of the aircraft.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's important. In there.
You can lie on an aircraft.
It's
probably a lie. We can't prevent people from lying.
That's it. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Then interferes in the operation of air carrier, airport or heliport. Section 101, a person who interferes with the operation of an air carrier, airport or heliport is guilty of an offense. Nuisance, disorderly or indecent act on board aircraft. Mr. Chairman, we inserted the indecent act given some recent experiences on the, on my own, but it happened on the aircraft.
I just wanted to check, because this describes on board behavior, and we have had incidents of people on the ground before embarkation getting into trouble because of declarations. I just want to be sure whether that falls under this act or where is it provided for. Where we say somebody makes a false declaration, which the chairperson said we must say, and thereby endangers the flight and so on. We've had incidents, I mean, where people before embarkation, say for example, joke that they've got a bomb in their baggage. I just wanted to confirm that is uncontrolled or regulated by another law.
It's covered on the next section 121. Your exact point is covered in section 121.
Maybe not for now, but maybe we should ask the technical advisor just to think about, I mean, what do we mean by indecent act? whether that is not rather elastic. I mean, I don't know, but whether that's clear enough in law
and whether the words are orderly. And if we're going to think about the import of words like that, if one, you know, you can imagine that there's quite a spectrum of meaning to what can be from very crude notions of what it's
Okay, smoking on board aircraft, tampering with smoke detectors, operating portable electronic devices when prohibited, like your cell phones, etc. A person who smokes on board an aircraft, tampers with smoke detector, or operates a portable electronic device when prohibited is guilty of an offense. This, I'm going to pause, and this is our favorite topic, Mr. Chairman, baggage kept at airport. Okay. And we try to find a way of fixing this in this bill. And what we found is that in terms of, and we've been advised, in terms of criminal prosecution, you need to have the owner of the bag present to open a charge for a bag that has been tampered or pilfered as such. The challenge you have in this industry is that very likely that person is sitting at some other country and one never will possibly not return to South Africa in the near future. A tourist, a businessman, and chance of getting a prosecution to stick as such is not going to happen. So we then looked at airport operations and what we're trying to set out to achieve. And if you read how we've written the act as such or the bill as such, what we say is that a person who, within an aerodrome and without authority, tampers with, opens, or damages a bag or cargo is guilty of an offense. Detains or keeps cargo, induces any person to deliver, dispose of such cargo or baggage is also guilty of an offense. Now, from a practical point of view, if there is baggage pilferage, very likely you would get a person that would remove items from a bag and go and store it at a particular locker or whatever. And by having this provision in the Act now, we are in a position to take prosecution steps against that particular individual. Okay. So it's very much like we won't be able to charge you on theft, but we're going to charge you for tampering on the bag. And the complainant can be the inspectors at the airport, it could be the security official, it could be even the baggage handling company management or staff, whoever, that says, I saw X, Y, and Z steal and I can prove it. And you go on that basis. Prohibition and control in aircraft, section 125. A person may not board or attempt to board an aircraft if such person is in possession of any harmful article. A person who wishes to consign any harmful article must do so in a manner prescribed by regulation or the convention. Prohibition and control in restricted area in the aviation facilities. No person may enter a restricted area while in possession of any harmful article unless that person is an authorized person. Authorized in writing to be in that restricted area. A person or crew member who is in the restricted area for purposes of taking possession of baggage containing a harmful article. Authorized persons or person in control of aviation facility may refuse entry into such restricted area. Prohibition of convenience of armaments, drugs, or animal products. Except for written permission of the minister, no person shall convey armaments, drugs, or animal products in an aircraft. Aircraft which is believed to be conveying armaments, drugs, or animal products is subject to the regulations regarding identification and interception of aircraft with regard to the Tokyo Convention. Authorized persons may, without a warrant, search any aircraft if reasonably believed aircraft is used to convey armaments, drugs, or animal products. Seize any armaments, drugs, or animal products. Seize any aircraft on which armaments, drugs, or animal products are found, and arrest any person who is found on board an aircraft when reasonably suspected of having committed such an offense.
Can you throw on the animal products?
Yeah, I want to check about plant material. That's a significant area.
Sections 128.1 clearly defines animal products. It says, for the purpose of the section, animal products means a rhinoceros, horn, and elephant tusk, or any part thereof, which is processed contrary to the provisions of any other legislation.
Okay, so it's not animal products in general.
No. However, having said that, Mr. Chairman, one also, I think, perhaps also take into cognizance, certain states prevent one from, for example, you can't take biltong. but that falls under the Department of Agriculture in this country, in their legislation and their relevant respective departments in other countries as such.
But this
act is these issues. You know, you don't take an animal tusk on one aircraft as such.
Yeah. Just in addition to my question about plant products, I suppose this would be specified. Plant products would be specified with agriculture.
Yes.
But my question is, why don't we cross-check with the relevant act, which is administered by the Department of Agriculture, and would there be a need to cover the same scope under animal products and equally under plant products? You've got a rhino horn, and there could be the hide of another animal, which is an endangered species, mm-hmm. and so on. Apart from it being an endangered species, there are also questions of disease control. Is it our intention only to protect these three, or is it also to deal with matters of disease control?
Very important point. Whilst we made provision in terms of a blanket provision to say it possesses consider the provision of any other legislation, there's no harm in doing what the Honourable Member, I think, is requiring us to do. We can cross-reference with the other piece of legislation and we can obviously infer. There's no harm in that. In fact, it just spells it out a lot more clearer.
The wording is actually taken from existing legislation. At the time we were looking at this, we came up with the same concern, is that there are other prohibited products as well. And by including only these two products, in fact, may really prevent us from going further than that.
Yes, this is always problematic.
Security Section 129, a minister may, if of the opinion and action by any person or groups of persons, threaten safety of an aircraft, airport, or aviation facility, may issue orders as necessary to counter such action. Authorized persons may take such steps as necessary to comply with the order, and the person who fails or refuses to give effect to such order is guilty of an offense. Penalties are covered in Section 120, 129, 131, 134, 140. Section 130 deals with person who contravenes or commits an offence under this Act, Convention, or Transit Agreement is liable to a fine or imprisonment. If a person is holder of a license certificate, the court may cancel or suspend such license certificate. The director may impose an administrative penalty for failing to comply with the Act. If a person fails to pay administrative penalty, the CA may recover amount from such person. Search, seizure, and powers of arrest for authorized persons are covered in Section 131. Authorized person may, in interest of aviation security, without a warrant, search person, baggage, vehicles, etc., and that's an everyday practice from the existing act we do at the airport. Minister may direct manager of airport to ensure that the search of all persons, baggage, vehicles, personnel, etc. Failure to comply with direction of minister is an offense. The airport manager may direct authorized person to conduct search of persons, vehicle, baggage, personnel, etc., if necessary for the security of the airport. The authorized person may, if it is believed that a search is necessary for security of any airport, without warrant, search any building, structure, equipment, etc. Authorized person may, in writing, order persons who refuse to be searched to leave airport or heliport immediately. Any search contemplated in the section must be conducted with strict regard for decency and order, with respect for each person's right to dignity, freedom, security, and privacy. Seizure or retention of harmful articles. Authorized person may seize any harmful article found during a search carried out in Section 131. The harmful article seized must be delivered to a police official. Section 133 and 134 deal with the powers of arrest and call for identification by authorized persons. authorized person may, without warrant, arrest any person who has committed or is suspected to have committed an offence referred to in this Act. Authorized person may, if it is considered necessary in the interest of security, call upon any person in any airport and navigation facility to supply full name and address. Delegation of powers. The minister may delegate to the director or employer of the department any power conferred by section 129(1) and 132(2) and 6.
Just going back to the question that was asked by Dr. Kumara, the early one about uttering falsehoods, for instance, not on a plane, but at the airport, in the queue or whatever. You said it's covered, but is it covered?
Yes.
The
offensive
I'm not
looking
out in the summary, but I wouldn't say
Interfering with air operation of air carrier, airport, heliport, section 121B. Next slide. Acts of omission taking place outside the Republic, section 136 continued. Any act contemplated in section 125, 126, 127, 128 committed outside the Republic on board any aircraft in flight other than a South African registered aircraft, an act of violence against passengers or crew is considered to have been committed in the Republic. If aircraft lands in the Republic but a person who committed the act is still on board, if such aircraft is leased without crew to a lessee who has principal place of business in the Republic, if a person is present in the Republic, if a person is apprehended in the Republic. Jurisdiction, any offence contemplated in section 126(2) is considered to have been committed in any place where the accused happens to be or is found. Extradition, section 138. For purpose of the Extradition Act 1962, an offence committed on board an aircraft in flight, an aircraft registered in convention country must, while in flight, be considered to be within the jurisdiction of that country. Landing of aircraft in any convention country with offender on board will result in offence being considered to have been committed in that country. And where aircraft was leased without crew to a lessee who has principal place of business in convention country, offence to be considered to have been committed in that country. Administrability of Statement, section 139. In court proceeding in the Republic for offence committed on board an aircraft and person cannot be found in the Republic, statement relating to subject matter is admissible as evidence is made under oath. An officer having functions corresponding to the function of the Republic of a judge or magistrate or counselor officer and in the presence of the person charged with the offence. Powers on board an aircraft, section 140. Commander of an aircraft in flight believes that any person on board has or is about to do any act which jeopardizes the safety of the aircraft, the commander must take measures to protect the safety of the aircraft and persons to maintain good order and discipline on board. Any person on board may render assistance in restraining persons whom commander is entitled to restrain. Commander of an aircraft may disembark any person in any country in which that aircraft may be and deliver that person to the relevant officials. The next section we have is the National Civil Aviation Security Coordinator. I'm going to pause and just bring us to speed on this issue. In terms of a CAIO and its assembly into security, the state has an obligation to ensure that it has a national aviation safety program. Well, why is it called a national aviation safety program?
Animal products. Sorry to take you back. Does it mean one can take animal also on the aircraft?
Yeah.
Not products, but animals, can it?
Okay. I'll answer that in a particular way. Well, animal products, obviously, you would mean animals that are dead. But yes, in terms of taking live animals aboard aircraft, you can take on pets, but they would be in the cargo hold of the aircraft, not on board the aircraft as such, or in the passenger area as such.
Regulation.
Yeah, and those are covered in regulations. Okay.
Can a blind person take a guide dog on his car?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Okay. All right, on this particular issue, in terms of ACAIO and the National Aviation Safety Program, and when I say safety, it's actually security, but that's how it's titled by ACAIO. The state has an obligation to produce a National Aviation Safety Program, which covers security, and such program must be approved by, in this case, the Minister of Transport in South Africa's instance. Now, what it requires is that the state will appoint a National Aviation Security Coordinator. The provisions are very silent in terms of where that particular person should be placed, whether they must be placed within the ambit of the police services or the CAA or a relevant department. It's silent. It does not tell you where that person must be placed. But it describes to you what that person must deliver, a National Aviation Safety Program. And that program must be provided as follows. It should tell airports what's required of them in terms of technical issues, how many security personnel, whether they must have a perimeter fence that's 5 meters high, those kind of issues. The airports in turn, and in South Africa, we currently have, within the National Aviation Safety Program, 20 designated airports. Each airport must then supply its own security plan. And such plan must be approved, and the CAA then monitors in terms of them fulfilling what they have outlined in their plan. Now, we have currently, in terms of capacity, the Office of the Chief Civil Aviation Security, a product that has flowed out of regulation. Currently, the Chief for Aviation Security has been tasked with the National Aviation Safety Program. Moving forward,
and that chief is located?
That chief currently was located at the CAA, currently on secondment to the Department of Transport. And to answer you more directly, Chairman, this person is based at the Department of Transport, not based at the department. Moving forward, the approach taken is that the National Aviation Security Coordinator, and I'll move the presentation, the Minister appoints the coordinator who is an employee of the department, as put in this current bill. The coordinator is accountable to the Director General. The coordinator holds office for a period not exceeding 3 years and may be reappointed. I'm going to pause in that particular line. When I say maybe reappointed, we also want to flag to the committee the concern we have, given that this is security, we should apply the same principle of not more than 2 terms. This is the concern. Okay, further appointment to be done by the Director General. The coordinator holds office on a full-time basis. The coordinator must be a South African citizen, be a fit and proper person, and have top security clearance. Conflict of interest, section 142. The coordinator or his or her spouse, immediate family member, life partner, or business associate may not hold any direct or indirect financial interest in any civil aviation activity without prior approval of the minister. The responsibility of the coordinator, section 143, is the coordinator is responsible for the development of national civil aviation security policies, compilation, revision, and coordination of the National Aviation Safety Program, monitoring and enforcement of the NAS, developing effective enforcement strategies to secure compliance with aviation security standards and assessment of security-related decisions taken by the industry. Determination by the Minister, section 144, the Minister must, with concurrence of the coordinator and CEO of the relevant designated airport, in consultation with the CAA, approve appointment of person responsible for the execution of the security plan of such airports. I just want to pause there. We can go to section 144.
Okay. Let me just check one thing. In terms of the coordinator, Chair, I just want to check whether this coordinator will be in a form of a one person, or it will be in a person of group, or it will be in a person of company.
Okay.
And where will this person be based in all these aviation sites?
Okay. I think the honourable member has asked a very prudent question. The person, as is outlined, is a one person model. Where the person will be based, it will be at the Department of Transport as covered in the bill. And the last part that you raised, how will the person control in terms of security in the country, I think that's where we have outlined that the South African Civil Aviation Authority has the mandate for oversight in terms of both security and safety. So if one looks at the function of the coordinator, it's more administrative in nature in terms of compiling the National Aviation Security Plan, ensuring that the airports have the National Aviation Security Plans put in place and are approved, and that the CAA are on the same loop, and the CAA provides oversight to ensure that what's in the plan is actually executed on the shop floor. I hope I've answered the honourable member.
Okay. Can we have a sense of international
practices?
Okay.
Location, in terms of location, because we're starting now to get quite a lot of different entities.
I think the simple way to answer the honourable chairman is this, is that one must look at capacity and executional provisions. The CAA is the most appropriate positioned entity that has the capacity and can execute the provisions of the NASC. So if there is a coordinator and the coordinator does the National Aviation Safety Program, that person should ideally be at the CAA.
Yeah, but I was asking if it, and international comparison.
Well, internationally, all authorities globally, when I say all, with the exception of perhaps the United States, which has a very advanced or matured state of affairs in terms of security, they have the Federal Aviation Administration, which takes care of what the CAA does in terms of safety oversight for aviation. And then they have the Transport Security Administration, which takes care of the security aspects for transportation. Other states, with the likes of the New Zealand, Australia, United Kingdom, they have this particular function within the ambit of the CAA. And correct me if I'm wrong, Renee, you've been around.
It differs from, it really differs a lot from state to state.
In fact, I think in New Zealand it resides within the Department of Justice.
Is it?
Mm. But it varies. But generally it's normally within the Civil Aviation Authority.
Obviously something we need to
focus on.
Advantages and processing.
I think in terms of functionality, the bill is not problematic. We know what the functions are. Those are quite clearly spelled out by the Bakayo. I think it's the institutional arrangement that...
What are the advantages of it not being located?
I can't think of any.
The only possibility is that the major role of the security coordinator would be policy, and policy traditionally lies with the department, as opposed to operational enforcement and activity, which lies within the CAA. So from that perspective, that might be a reason to say that the security coordinator should be part of the Department of Transport. But that would be the only one that we could think of.
Right. Where are we now? Okay. This point, section 144. And the reason why we inserted this particular clause without going into detail of history is that we believe that the airport in the country, being national key point, must have a natural born South African responsible for security. And past practice has shown that if you get expats or
not a sovereign South African citizen, you open yourself up to a number of uncanny practices.
We remember.
So that's the reason why we inserted it. Okay, regulation section 145. The minister may make regulations regarding carrying out of or giving effect to the convention and transit agreement, the powers and duties of the director, qualifications, powers or duties of authorized persons, inspectors and authorized persons, and designation of medical examiners. Designation of one or more bodies for the purpose of exercising control over medical examination and tests, exercising control over the training courses specified in the regulations, exercising control over the aviation recreational activities specified in the regulations, the promotion of aviation safety or to reduce the risk of aircraft accidents or aircraft incidents, the reporting or of the investigation of aircraft accidents or incidents, and other aspects giving effect to this act. Now, whilst we speak of all these different issues, we must bear in mind that the Aviation Act of 1962 has a ton of regulations which will still be in play when this bill becomes an act, because there is no variation to the regulation that needs to be brought about, unless, of course, it's an industry issue. Okay.
Other than that, wherever a regulation speaks to the previous act, that'll have to be amended. So we will have to go through a full process of looking at an amendment of the regulations. Plus, we have identified that our regulations are rather unwieldy and tend to over-regulate. So when we go through this particular process, we will be, through our Civil Aviation Regulations Committee, look at streamlining the regulations to make them easier to implement and easier for industry to understand.
Then on technical standards, section 146, the director may issue technical standards for civil aviation. The transitional provisions are provided for in section 147. Authorization, certificates, licenses, permissions or registrations issued in terms of an act repealed by this act remains valid for periods specified in the authorization or certificate. Person who occupies a post or serves in a particular capacity continues in the corresponding post or capacity. Person who received an allowance, remuneration, or benefit continues to receive such allowance, remuneration, or benefit. Powers exercised or duty performed by the CEO or the committee of solution must be considered as having been exercised or performed by the director. Section 148 deals with matters pending under previous acts. Promulgation of this act does not affect any proceedings instituted in terms of the previous acts administered by the CAA. Section 149 deals with amendment and repeal of laws. The laws mentioned in Schedule 1, which is attached to this bill, are amended to the extent set out in the schedule. And in section 150 basically binds, makes this act bind the state as such. Short title and commencement in section 151. This act is called the Civil Aviation Act 2008 and comes into operation on a date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. Okay. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair, thanks. Chair, I want to raise quite a number of issues. But first and foremost, Chair, I want to go back to the issue that I raised earlier on the issue around security coordinator. I find it very difficult, Chair, for a security coordinator to be appointed. And that security coordinator should be based in the department. I would have a difficulty, Chair, to understand what is exactly the role of that security coordinator going to be, being far away from aviation itself and be located in the department. What will his role exactly be? That's one. Two, Chair, the issue around the director. Earlier on, there was an issue that if the director is not there for a period of 2 weeks or for 30 days, the director will be replaced. And it was been emphasized that the director must be a person who has a capacity in terms of the aviation. He must have technical skills. Now I would wonder, Chair, that in the organogram of the structure, when you have your staff, will you say in each and every staff member who comes to be there, not knowing that earlier on the director won't be there. You need to say everybody who comes there must be a highly technical person. I find it very I'm looking for this way. I find it very difficult, Chair. Lastly, Chair, when we have been amending number of entities bills, we have emphasized the issue of the organized labor. I have seen throughout when we talk about Aviation Security Investigation Board, clearly there is a specification of who must come on board. I just want us maybe to check where do we locate the organized labor in that particular specific board. The other one is Civil Aviation Authority. Also, it's very clear that it needs highly technical people and so on and so on. But as we have been amending previously these other bills, we have been emphasizing the issue of organized labor. The last one, Chair, is on Appeals Committee. The Appeals Committee also, it has its own component. You see, this thing has got quite a number of, you know, entities, sub-entities and so on. To me, it's confusing. It's confusing, but maybe because this was just a preview for us to have an exactly insight. Maybe one will sit with this document and try to check exactly what is it that we want to achieve. But I'm telling you, Chair, it's very confusing to me. Maybe if I can, because I got this document today, maybe if I will sit down and go through this document, I will have a sense of exactly what is it that we want to achieve in this picture. Thanks.
Okay. I think maybe we'll invite comments on some of the points you raised, or many of the points
from our colleagues. But I think your last point is the main point, that I think certainly most, if not all, of the issues you're raising are exactly ones that we need to pursue further when we get into the public hearings stage. And whether they're raised or not by members of the public, we certainly must raise those matters. I don't know if there are any comments at this point on issues raised by offences. So Dr. Cephalora also wants to raise something.
Yeah. Well, Chips in slide 33, the last but one bullet. They require a physician, if so authorized by a patient, to provide information. Now, under the circumstances of an investigation, this is a matter of consent, may be problematic. What if the patient is obstructing the investigation by refusing to authorize the physician?
Okay. And also have a question. Chairperson, thanks. On certain aircrafts, they would allow, for example, myself to sit on top of my cushion. I'm sitting on a cushion. Especially when I fly 2 hours or longer distances. But in others, they would not allow me to do that. Okay? Say from Cape Town to Nyasbrit, I would fly more than 2 hours. Now, I need to sit on it, you know? And I might argue with the flight attendants, say, no, I must use it. And I'm allowed to use certain cars and others not. So there's no uniformity. And to get back to the question on the guide dog, I think it should also be in the regulations, in the act, or is it covered elsewhere? Because you might also find certain
attendance or won't allow it and others not. I think that one, because they might say the guide dog must go in the cage, you know, in the back, and it's assisting the patient. I think that must also be gotten in, other than the others, you know, specifically the guide dog, for example. What I'm saying, there's no uniformity. It's that some they would allow and the others they would not allow you. And then, which means certain classes would be an offense and others not. What would be
that? It was certainly after all the court's mentioned for those things. There's starts with offenses, Matthew. Many of which I think were on the big issues and maybe come to the details after.
I don't have any further response. I mean, the issues that we have been looking at. I don't know if anyone wants to unwind.
I think we'll respond just in broad context because we covered a number of the issues. I'll cover the first set of questions after the honourable member. The medical issues will be covered by Leon, and then the commissioner will cover the last issue in terms of the guide dog and the convenience issue for passengers as such. I think the first one is quite clear cut. We know and we've addressed that there's an institutional issue that we need to map out for the security coordinator. I don't think we'll reach consensus on what the right part is. Now, I think also in public comment, you probably will find that this will come out. Whilst the workload is well mapped out, where does this person reside is more the issue and the reporting structure.
It would be useful to look at the ICAO requirement. It's ICAO, is it? That's
yes.
Making this requirement. It would be useful to look at their wording, not that we have to be, I mean, we have to obviously at risk of, I mean, we need to kind of comply, clearly. But we presumably don't have to be complete flunkies in the process. I mean, we can develop our way of complying. But do they use the word, for instance, policy, role of, and so on? It might be, because it's not about developing policy particularly, it's about developing a plan. Which is like a set of regulations, in a sense, which is what the CA's core business is. And if the word policy is the one, the department should develop broad policy by way of white papers or whatever, which provide a broad political, you know, strategic guidance to entities like the CAA, that indeed is a functional thing. So I think it might be worth having a detailed look again at exactly what Coward's wording is, not necessarily be slaves to their wording either, but if I'd be interested in that if policy is something that they is a word they use for instance. But that's homework that we can do and can follow up on. Okay. Sorry, but I was just butting in because that was the first aspect of offences issue. Because I think collectively, those of us provisionally, I mean, obviously we need to also mull over it. It seems like too many entities and lack of uncertainty, lines of command and so on, can get a bit confused in all of this. An already overstretched department might find itself actually not coping with it. Yeah. Okay.
Right. On the second issue regarding the director and the acting and stuff, we are very careful when we draft this, and we know that the nature of the Solution Authority is very technical in being. The CAA has an executive board that reports to the director, and on the executive board, I'm talking about an operational level now, we have a general manager of flight operations, a general manager of airworthiness. These are technically competent people that can act as the director. So we are well conscious of the fact that if the director, for whatever reason, decides he's going to go off for 15 or 20 days, that there are competent people that he can appoint. And likewise, the minister is well briefed in terms of the organogram of who can be appointed on a period longer than 30 days, going up to 12 months and such. That's a more practical issue.
Chair, I think the only case for the minister being involved if the period is more than 30 days, if, for example, the director takes ill and he's going to be out of office for 2 to 3 months, then we decided that the minister should be involved in the decision of who's going to act over that period, because it is a lengthy period, and because the minister originally appoints, he should have that ability to do it. And that is what is envisaged, as opposed to the director leaving the position and having to somebody else having to be reappointed. But right now we probably have about 4 to 6 people who are more than competent technically and administratively to carry that position for a period of time.
Thank you. On the issue of the many structures, and the honourable members quite rightly put it out, we need to read the bill because it's extensive in terms of technical language and jargon. And the fact that this is an industry that needs to ensure that it complies with FAR, there is a requirement for an appeals committee. You can't make an annotated decision on multiple in an industry and ground an aircraft and say we'll wait for a court hearing in 6 months or 7 months from now. There's got to be a process that runs for it. So the provision is made. And then in terms of the medical issue, I'll let Leon respond.
Mr. Chair, the question posed by the honourable member with regards to the bullet number, the second last bullet in slide 33, which refers to the requirement of a physician in terms of the powers of investigators, only relates to accident investigations in terms of Chapter 4 as such, and it is also subject to constitutional control in terms of section 3235. If there is a refusal, a person investigator may approach court in certain circumstances. It's not a general provision, it only relates to investigations in terms of that specific chapter. If that's of assistance to the honourable member.
Chair, at the moment those issues are covered in regulation, not in the primary legislation, and the reason for that is because aircraft types differ dramatically, and not all aircraft in fact can accommodate guide dogs, which traditionally are large dogs like Labradors and Alsatians, and therefore it is actually left up to the operator to establish what their particular policy is with regard to this issue based on the type of aircraft that they operate. But the regulations do allow for it. They do allow for guide dogs specifically to be carried in the cabin. But if a particular aircraft type just physically can't accommodate a guide dog, then obviously the operator decides that they won't be able to accommodate blind passengers in that regard. And therefore to make it a pre-requirement is virtually impossible. With regard to the use of special cushions, again, that I can only think would be, again, a particular operator saying the reason you can't use a cushion is because of safety reasons, because of A, B, C, D. Again, there's no requirement in any of our regulations that either stipulate that you may or may not use it. But it does tend to be related to the aircraft type. And certain small aircraft just may not be able to restrain you correctly if you are sitting on top of a cushion. So, and again, because of the hundreds of different types of aircraft that operate in the country in commercial aviation, it is extremely difficult to make a specific regulation stipulating that you will allow a disabled passenger to sit on a cushion. I think it has to be left up to the operator to determine in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendation.
Yeah, Chairperson. You see, it's like with the judges, the spotlight, it's like the attendant can be a judge. Attendant can decide by him or herself whether to allow it or not, whilst the more acceptable would be a referee. When you handle a ball in a penalty area, it's a penalty, you see. It's like on any aircraft that you enter, these commercial aircraft, whether it's these small ones, Air Link, or the Boeing, they go to Jobo, the Air Link, they go to PE, it's difficult to accept the one would allow you and the other not. I would understand if they say You can't sit maybe at the door across the entrance, exit or so. But how can the blind person, for example, not be allowed to enter the craft because he can't enter the craft with he or a guide? Is that not discriminating against the person? I mean, they must
be some... Now ask you a question, Michael. Because the response we're getting is that, and obviously we have to be reasonable about that, is that obviously some aircraft are very small and so on, and so unfortunately it is discriminated against someone that requires a guide dog. But it's just physically unsafe for everybody, including the guide dog, to allow... one can imagine certain circumstances in which that might be the case. So there's going to be variation. But in your experience, have you found the same size aircraft, same airline even perhaps, coming up with different requirements in a way that they can't come in? Because part of what you're saying is that you... What was implied in your question seemed to me was that the air crew themselves seem to be inconsistent in their application. Is that a correct understanding of
experience? It's the inconsistency.
Yes.
Because the small ones, you would go to air links, no? I would go to PE, they would just allow me. I would then go to East London,
yeah.
Same size,
yeah.
They would allow me. So the discussion of the attendant, I'm saying that is my problem.
But you don't know where you are, and you can't anticipate what is going to happen, because it has to be not a policy, maybe an operating policy, but you are on the plane and you're not sure what's going to happen, and the decision is going to be made by the individual aircraft.
So what I would like to recommend that we do, factors to put into our regulations that an operator is required in the operations manual to specify for each aircraft type whether or not such a cushion is allowed, and then it's clear cut. So if you're operating on this particular aircraft, you can. If you're operating that one, you can't. And once it's in the operations manual, all crew are required to be conversant with the operations manual, and then it's straightforward and it's clear cut. And certainly we will make note of that and look at bringing a regulation in to deal with that one.
But why don't we try to be a little bit more systematic? If we're dealing with a specific experience of one member who has a disability, but maybe we should invite, not necessarily in the course of these hearings, but it's useful that we have you here for the DBSA or something like that to make a formal representation about this issue about inconsistency. And I think the disability sector needs to be sensitive obviously to the fact that not everything is always possible. They know that very well, all too well from daily experience, but it's the inconsistency particularly. And
sure, that's exactly the process that we would follow.
No, exactly, okay. So in fact, what you're undertaking to do is to engage formally with the DBSA and to say, help us to develop some regulation which then introduces some degree of consistency. Okay, well, thanks for that undertaking.
Just with regard to blind passengers, all cabin crew as part of their training are required to undergo training with regard to assisting blind passengers and to brief them specifically. It is not a requirement to have a guide dog. There's a specific way in which disabled passengers in general are dealt with, but blind passengers specifically. And it may be assigning a person that sits next to that person, they term an able-bodied person, who will then, in the event of an evacuation or whatever it is, actually assist this particular person with the evacuation. There's a full briefing process that takes place. So provision is made on board all aircraft to accommodate blind passengers, and it is done so on a regular basis.
In an area of some problem, which you will be aware of better than us, I mean, there was a flight of people who were just put off. I think it was coming from the start, if I remember correctly.
Actually, I was involved in that,
yes,
when I was still in my previous job. But what all manufacturers do is they actually stipulate how many disabled passengers you can have per regular crew complement. So if you have four cabin crew members, you can have a total of six disabled passengers. If you have more than that, you're required to carry additional trained, not necessarily cabin crew members, but trained staff. And very often what the airlines do is they train ground staff. and they'll either pre-assign them, or if it happens at the last moment, they will take people that are qualified and put them on board the airplane to assist. But there is a regulatory requirement so that you have enough people on board who are trained to deal with the type of disability that you have on board.
Just one final example. I was saying last year, for example, when a disabled person travels, a particular person in a wheelchair, he or she must be accompanied by an assistant. Meaning, if a disabled person wants to travel anywhere, he or she must pay double, because to have an assistant, it means it's two per persons. I'm fine in Parliament. I'm paid for to have an assistant. But any person who's disabled want to go anywhere must pay double for the same destination. I mean, that's the point. You pay double, while other people or able-bodied persons pay. It's only one person that is allowed to enter the car.
I respond, Chair. As far as I recall, it only is required in the case of specific disabilities. But very often, normal wheelchair passengers come on board without company people, and it happens on a daily basis. You see the PAU pull up, they're taken out in the wheelchair, they have either slip a wheelchair, and they're not accompanied by anybody. So there are regular people travelling that are wheelchair disabled people, and they don't require an accompanying person. But I know that from a medical point of view, at some point in time, the medical requirements are that you may have to have an accompanying person. But it's not a given. It's done on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
Did
say something. Thank you for your assurance that you would follow up, particularly the concern around the issue of what appears to be inconsistent. Okay. Any other
There was slide 38, Chairperson, which corresponds to 40 sub 2. Person may be removed as an observer. Now, why don't we state it as just a simple exclusion rather than create the possibility that a person may start with the process, we discover after the fact that they've got a conflict of interest and then remove them. Why don't you just make it an exclusion of persons with conflict of interest? Because investigations are often very extensive and so on. If the presence of a person with a conflict of interest would compromise investigations and so on, and we discover this midstream, a lot of what would have been done up to that point may go to waste. So why don't we state it as an exclusion?
Section 40 on page 3. So the fundamental ground for the new one of the different points of view, the condition,
and the point I'm making, yes, the person who contravenes, I mean, would have been admitted, would have qualified and been admitted as an observer, and maybe during the course of this investigation they violate those rules. But the one who has a conflict of interest, I'm saying that can be predetermined, or that can be pre-stated as an exclusion, as grounds for exclusion to participate.
Any
Why do you let them in first and then remove them later?
Chair, if I may respond to the honourable member. In many cases, the party, for example, may be the owner of an aircraft and are required to participate in the investigation because of certain issues. And normally, they would not impede the investigation. But if, in the opinion of the lead investigator, that individual tries to exert undue influence on the outcome of the investigation, that's when you would exclude them from the investigation. But normally, in the normal case, a lot of people with vested interests do take part in the investigation. I just take, for example, every time that you have a large airliner crashing, the manufacturer is intimately involved and has to be intimately involved in that particular investigation. If we put this type of clause in, it would preclude them from participating in the investigation, which would result in no real outcome. We leave the discretion then up to the chief investigator.
One has to keep in mind that immediately following an accident, there is tremendous pressure on the investigator in charge to get his team together. And he may accept an observer in the heat of the moment on good faith and then find there is a conflict of interest or impediment later on. Therefore, we do need this kind of exclusive clause if something like that is developed. But you are under tremendous pressure within a few hours after the accident to get the team together. You may make decisions in good faith, which is not certain.
I don't know, it's maybe a question of drafting. So it's not necessarily a conflict of interest, but it may be the conduct.
The
conflict, they say the conflict of interest does not in itself impede, because you may need the owner of the aircraft to assist, but it becomes a problem when their conduct during the investigation. Okay, but here it says the observer has a conflict of interest that impedes the conduct of the investigation. And I'm saying that it suggests that the conflict of interest itself can become an obstacle. Whereas I think the problem here is that the person who may be admitted because they are an interested party and we need them begins to behave in a manner that obstructs.
Exactly.
So this phrase here then needs to be clarified or redrafted.
Which might just involve removing a conflict of interest and saying an observer whose conduct begins to impede the conduct of something, because that's what we're trying. Otherwise, it can create a. I think we all know what we're trying to get at. It's just a question. Anything else from anybody else for the moment? Okay, it looks as though we've done what I was hoping we would do today, and that is get a good sense of the overall layout of the bill, have a sense of where we might run into some prickly areas. I suspect that when we get, we might find some challenges also around, we flagged two main areas, which is the institutional type issues, board issues, and location of the, whatever it is, forget all the new names, but it's whatever sector. The one that does the planning. Okay. Sorry. We don't have.
I just want to check with the chairperson if we don't have any regional bodies or conventions. Sorry.
Whether we don't have any regional entities.
Yes. That could be relevant to this.
No. Okay. It's more our country affiliation to ICAO. Is the key thing, plus those series of agreements that go back to the 40s and so forth that are the governing things that we need to comply with, essentially. So we flagged those two issues. We might, when we get to public hearings, also find some challenges around investigative powers, seizure of powers, and so on. We would be less hung up as a committee, but you can imagine that there would be vested interests that would want to tame down the capacities, and there it will be very useful to look to come well armed with international examples and best practice type benchmarks and things like that. So I think our certainly on a first reading of it, our major concerns will be the institutional ones and making sure that the different entities we're setting up, that we're not setting up too many dispersed entities on the one hand, on the other hand, that there are clear lines of demarcation and responsibility between entities. I think that those are the key things we flag. Okay, I forget the exact date. Voikazi might help me, but I think that we plan to get back again on this on. There's a gap for a space for us to get back on Thursday next week, but I'm inclined not to do that because I'm inclined to allow the time we've made available for public representation, written comments, to come in, because I think we've, I think that's when we can do more detailed and effective work. So that with the presence of all of those who've come this morning, our colleagues from outside of Parliament have come to then also then sit down with whatever public representations we get by way of written submissions or and oral if we allow them, and then to engage in a process. And we'd certainly benefit with your presence. I mean, I don't know if you need to bring such a large team, but that's great. But certainly a spread of expertise that would enable us to do justice to the goal. So then we're talking about 7th, 8th of October would be our target then for getting down to. And although a lot of it is, for the moment, it is quite straightforward, actually. It's quite long, but a lot of it is cut and paste, I think, from what exists. It's detail, which is important detail, but which is not, I don't think, terribly problematic, subject to what we might hear from the aviation industry or whatever. But the institutional things might be a little bit of a challenge, but shouldn't be too complicated either. I mean, once we've made up our mind collectively as to what is the best line, shouldn't necessarily be too complicated, particularly in the drafting side of things. So maybe we can finish quite quickly. Maybe in that early October slot. I suspect this can take longer than, what did you say, 7th, 8th? Might take a little bit longer than that, but hopefully not much longer, subject to what comes up. Any comments from your side?
No, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, firstly, the committee for getting us out. I know we are a bit boring with the technical issues, but we'll try our utmost best to rectify a number of issues as flagged by the committee members before we get to the public hearing as such. And you can be rest assured that we'll give it our best input as such to ensure that the bill that we present is a bill that we can work with in many, many years to come with.
Good. Thank you.
Chief, I may just also thank the honourable members of the committee for the chance to present our side of things. I would just like to indicate, in terms of the board and the corporate governance role, that since there's been a change in the way that we are audited, we're now audited by the Auditor General, and we're required, in fact, to conduct performance agreements with the Auditor General as well as with the department. We find that we are now reporting on three fronts in every single area. I had a discussion with my executive just to find out what their feeling was with regard to the board, and at this point in time, our whole executive, which consists of very experienced members of the CA, believe that we could certainly function very well within all of the ambit of the PFMA without a board. Thank you, Chair.
I appreciate that as well, but we need to thank you. Okay. Well, thanks everybody, and we'll see each other in early October.